Welcome, everyone, and Patreons, to part two of episode 9 of Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, Trans People Drive Fascists Bananas with Sarah Kaplan. I'm really grateful for your support, and I hope this project brings some joy, hope, and utility to your works and days. And I'll just reiterate that my plan for these second parts is to review and maybe reflect a little beforehand on what I learned in part one, and then roll the rest of the conversation, and then come back with further reflections. So I've got some key quotes from Kaplan from our part one. Fascism is ultimately a flight from freedom, from the uncertainty of existence. It retreats into rigid categories like binary gender because that feels safer than facing chaos. She also said, just by existing, trans people show that gender isn't universal. And that's terrifying to fascists because it proves their whole worldview isn't natural law. And then she also talked about some of the personal aspects of being trans in this climate. She said, sometimes being trans feels like being Cassandra. You see what's coming, you warn people, and still no one listens. We also talked about her use of philosophy in her practice of activism, but also just community. And she said, quote, philosophy doesn't give me comfort, but it slows things down, and it keeps me from being swept away by the acceleration that fascism thrives on. So we'll pick up part two of my conversation with Sarah Rose Kaplan, right at the point where we're discussing her one-woman show responding to Matt Walsh's What is a Woman? And your answer for him, it switches the frame a little bit by asking whether or not a regular person can define what a chair is. So how does that one go?
Yes. So my answer to him is this: for the frame that I'm switching is I'm trying to not convince him, because I won't, but convince in my audience that this is a bad question. The way that you don't fall for this is you recognize that it is a bad question. So to demonstrate in part why in philosophy these kinds of questions of looking for some universal definition are never really how anyone does anything. I returned to a classic philosophy example from my intro philosophy class back in college, where many professors all over the world are asking their students to try to define chair. And because this was a show, instead of just asking people to argue about the definition of chair, I showed my audience a bunch of different objects that may or may not be chairs in a slideshow. The game is shout out chair if it's a chair and shout out not chair if it's not a chair. And it is amazing how many objects people disagree about whether or not they are chairs. The point I'm trying to make here is Matt Walsh is depending on this like fallacious intuition that because woman is a simple word you've known your whole life, that you do know what it is in some way that's universal. Not just that like you know the word, you use it, but that you use it correctly because it's a simple word. But chair is also a very simple word we've known our whole life. And yet this room full of 70 adults, all of whom are fluent in English, we're routinely disagreeing on whether or not a given object counted as a chair or not. And yeah, so the point for me there is no such thing as a clean or universal language. There are no clean and shared universal definitions, especially for common words that evolved through social usage, like chair or woman. Like you could probably cleanly define something like Netflix, because that's a constructed word.
Right.
But the word chair evolved through endless one-on-one negotiations over centuries between all different kinds of cultures. And for some people, a stool is a chair, and for some people, it isn't.
There's a street comedian named Walter Masterson, and he makes a similar point as he's trolling like a Moms for Liberty convention or something like that, where he is asking the panel whether they can define an adult human female, but his focus is on the problem of the word adult. And, you know, of course, he brings up the fact that, you know, the age of consent is different in different places. And, you know, the definition of adult status is a very fluid thing. Is this the same argument?
They're very similar. And they're both circling the same idea, which is that you're never going to get to this place of clean universal language that the fascists want to pretend that they are using.
Right.
There's two key, I'm going to force myself into saying two key spots where they're different. One, his specific point there is the reason that he's focusing on adult human female is because that's the definition provided by people from J.K. Rowling all the way to now. It's just what Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh and Jordan Peterson and all these sort of fascists and intelligentsia use, and it's made its way into Congress and everything now. And the point is, look, we did it. It's this simple answer. You can't define woman, you people on the left, you woke people, but we can. It's an adult human female. Their point is to try to combat the point I'm making, which is, hey, words are more fluid than that. And so he's take kind of the next level down, and he's saying, well, no, because you're still using words. So yes, you did it in three words, but it's still not clean.
Right.
It's an answer. It's not the answer. It's pushing the question off to this other level. But what is adult? What is human? What is female? You could have done it with any of the three, because none of those have clean definitions. And it's interesting to me how much he focuses on adult as a legal category. Because I like using the word adult in answer to people parroting the Ben Shapiro thing of like, well, can I identify as 60?
Right.
And no, you can't just identify as 60, but people do identify as adult all the time. A lot of teenagers out there listening to this potentially. You might have this struggle where you consider yourself an adult and then the teachers or parents around you don't consider you an adult. And so there is a discrepancy there. I think the other difference for me is he's trying to show why that purported definition is fallacious. And my goal with chair is I really want people, even allies, like I want all of us, even trans people, I want us all to sit and confront the discomfort of the fact that language is inevitably imperfect. Like, part of it for me is I want us all to feel that there is kind of a spooky, chilling discomfort when you realize, like, oh wait, I've been using the word chair my whole life, and the way I use it is different from all these other people around me.
You know, I will agree with that, but I'll also say that I think that what Matt Walsh is doing with the assumption that the word woman has a stable and universal meaning that we're all agreeing to, is he is enforcing a kind of linguistic dominance that is performative in the moment. He's saying, can't you tell me what a woman is? And he's using the word, but behind the word, you can feel his body looming. You can kind of feel him taking up space in a way that you know is not going to be receptive to any kind of answer other than the one he wants. And so there's something, you can't really do what he's doing without also being a bully. And I think that when people have discomfort around, oh, do I actually know what chair is? And they might feel the ground underneath their feet sort of get a little bit, I don't know, gassy or something like that. They might feel like they're falling. They might feel like, oh, do I know what anything means? That is definitely an eerie feeling, but there's also freedom with that feeling in the sense that, you know, maybe my ideas about the way things are not necessarily, they don't need to be as rigid as I think. You know, maybe I don't know what chair means, and maybe that actually means I don't know everything about who I am either. And maybe that's a good thing.
100%. You know, you find out you and your friend don't agree on what a chair is, or you don't agree on what a sandwich is, you know, if you're having the hot dog sandwich debate or whatever. and people want to dismiss that as stupid, but it's actually not. It's actually really important. And I think it's really important when people have those conversations.
Yeah.
Because the kind of two main forks in that road are, no, I'm right, you're wrong, and I will be annoyed and frustrated unless you agree with me.
Right.
Or I will assume you're just playing devil's advocate, which is my least favorite accusation of, oh, you don't actually believe that. You're playing devil's advocate. You're just arguing for the sake of arguing.
Right.
Don't let anyone ever tell you that. That's not how it works. It's important to poke at the limits of our ideas. And so you can either decide that you're not taking this seriously because you don't agree with me, you're wrong, or you're being malicious, or it is this opportunity to think about, like, oh, wow, you're right. And there is this freedom of breaking objects away from the categories we use to limit them. And, like, really, is there anything in common between a Subway sandwich and a torta? Like, those are actually are completely different things that get reduced into the category sandwich.
But, you know, if a guy in Washington, D.C. throws either a Subway sandwich or a torta at an FBI agent, he's going to get arrested either way, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's also going to make for great social media. Very inspiring. Yeah.
I'm not saying you should do that because it's a waste of a torta, but a Subway sandwich, go for it. Yeah. And the other option is to use it as a chance to embrace each other. Like, wow, isn't it cool that we don't agree on this? I wonder why. Why do you think that object is a chair and I don't? And then you get to find out more about each other.
Yeah.
You know what? My mom is German, and in German, Stuhl refers to both objects equally. So she probably just used chair to refer to both. And that's why I do. Wow, that's interesting. Like, it's every one of these disagreements, or not even disagreements, just places of dissonance in our systems we use to understand the world, are opportunities to learn more about each other and ourselves. Yeah, I'm a big advocate of that.
One advantage, I think, conferred by philosophy, and I'll just point out that you kind of started out on a negative note, but I think we're talking it up a bit here, is affect. And, you know, the first thing that I noticed about you in your online content was you have this really calm and measured delivery. Like, it is relaxing to listen to you, to be honest. And, you know, you have another register on stage in the one woman show, but I'm wondering whether there's something strategic about the vibe of philosophy. Like, it seems to convey, I'm a reasonable person who doesn't get too excitable, and you can be too. But I'm wondering, like, does it also hide rage or help manage, you know, conflict in a way?
Yes. It's definitely strategic for me online. I sometimes record videos that are much angrier that I don't post.
They go in a special file.
They go in a special file just for
me. They're burning up your hard drive somewhere.
A lot of that is just something that I've always been that way. I think it's a big reason why, even though I was a nerdy queer kid, I wasn't ever really bullied growing up, is I was always very good at the appearance of equanimity and not reacting in the way that bullies wanted me to, which makes you less fun to bully. And I think a lot of that was also just depression, because I didn't know what being trans was. And so I just existed in this space of detachment and depersonalization.
You know, it's funny, whenever anybody says, you know, I seem to have this natural, I don't know, Buddhist approach to life, and you know, that was really helpful for me. But maybe it was also depression. I always hear those two things together.
Yeah, it's, I mean, of course,
who knows, like,
yeah, there's no way to know. I mean, I think when they go together, it's depression is in many ways just a deeper awareness of reality, and in some ways it's not, some ways it's your brain lying to you, and there's, it's really hard to parse. But on Instagram in particular, it is 100% a strategic choice.
Right.
It is, for me, a recognition of the fact that it's something I can do because I'm just maybe less by nature reactive and less prone to performing anger. And because I have the language of a philosophy degree and education, and I'm an improviser, and so I'm comfortable adopting like whatever emotion and performance I need to in the moment. That's a role I can play that most trans people right now simply don't have the bandwidth to, because these questions are unfortunately increasingly life and death.
Right.
These matter. And so it is, in part, 100%, like, comes back to the fact that I am privileged and I am in a position of, like, I tell trans people this all the time in my comments, who are like, there's no point arguing with these people. There's no point doing this. You know, you're trying to be calm. They won't listen. And I'm like, I know. But for me, it's important to try and reach the people I can. I'm not saying this is how other trans people need to be interacting with the world. This is how I can.
I also want to say, though, that if you're able to pull it off, which you clearly are, I wonder, and I don't want to make assumptions here, but like, I wonder whether the person who isn't able to, you know, affect 60 beats per minute, or however, you know, however you organize your rhythm, which is, you know, very methodical and I would say soothing, that provides a model. It's like, this can be done. And I think it brings a kind of, I don't know, promise of dignity, right? Like I did not have to be triggered in order to do what I'm doing. Or I can do what I'm doing without the feeling of impending danger.
I hope so. I mean, the comments I get that I love getting the most are from trans people saying things like, I'm so glad you made this video. You said something I've felt for a long time and not been able to put into words, or not wouldn't have been able to say. And that's really the thing I would most love to be doing with this platform, because I'm not an influencer. Like, when I posted that chair video, I had 1,100 followers. And in the few months since, I've gone from that to 45,000 as a result of that video. Like, Instagram tells you, it's like 90% that one random viral moment. And so for me, that's been a lot of thinking about, what do I want to do with this? This isn't a thing I worked to build up. It's not a thing that I like wanted necessarily, but I do have it now. And if what I can do is, yeah, perform this kind of calm intellectual transness, that it's also like 100, to be completely honest, a lot of it for me is a calculated reaction to the Gamergate, like YouTube misogyny, angry red-haired feminist yelling, freaking out. And that's so much of what the Matt Walsh documentary is too, is like triggering people to the point of them acting irrational by having emotion. And if I can outperform Matt Walsh in the arena of detached, calm, emotionless masculine discourse, then to me that feels like a win.
I think it's huge. I think that the study of affect and presentation is underdeveloped, but I think it is profoundly influential, and obviously it takes all types to fight fascism. And I think this is a really strong register for it. So the last question I have, you know, you've talked about a number of aspects that make your situation unique and privileged and, you know, and your own. But I also think that you probably have some generalized advice. And so that's what I want to ask you about to finish up. What would be your key advice for, let's say, the 13-year-old queer, non-binary or trans kid who, you know, wants to learn about, survive, and also fight back against fascism?
The most important thing you can do right now, if you're a 13-year-old queer kid out there, or any kind of kid who's worried about what's happening here, but especially the queer kids that I like to reach, the most important thing you can do right now is do your best. I know it's hard. Do your best to allow yourself the space to grow up. You are not like les résistance right now, you know?
Yeah, there was a little bit of pressure in that question, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I assume they're feeling it. Like, I don't think that, obviously, that's not coming out of nowhere. We're all feeling that right now. And especially when we exist all as much time as we do on social media and everything feels urgent and everything feels like our responsibility. And some of that is good. And too much of that is misleading. Like, as we talked about already multiple times here, like, fascism is powered by this sense of urgency. They want you to feel that. And there's all kinds of little left fascisms out there. Like, there's, I don't know about if you know anything about this, Matthew, but there's all kinds of like cults and groups and communities centered around charismatic leaders out there.
I know a little bit about cults, yeah.
And they want you, like, all these different groups want you to feel this urgency and make fast choices.
Right.
And if you are 13, some of you, unfortunately, are going to be put in situations where you do have to make fast choices right now. But to the extent to which you don't have to, allow yourself the chance to develop, explore, learn about yourself, try on different ways of being yourself. Who you are right now, who you are socially, doesn't have to be who you are tomorrow. If you want to try to be a different person, you can. And if you're worried about, like, people, this was a big thing for me growing up. Like, I was so in my head about people calling out anything I tried that deviated from the patterns I'd already built up. Push through that. That's bad. That's a bad impulse that I fell victim to. Like, I never hugged anyone growing up. And then when I was a teenager, I started trying to hug like my grandma and stuff. And every time she would say, "Oh, this is new." And I'd be like, "Well, grandma, now I don't want to do it." but it's important to play and experiment and grow. And you will be a better fighter against fascism. A better and more productive, not in the capitalist sense, but in like helpful and creative and imaginative member of your community, the communities that will need you in the future, if you've given yourself the chance to like really grow into yourself in all the ways you can be. And I think if you limit yourself right now to who you have to be in this moment to fight fascism, you'll be stunting your own growth. And we don't need you today. We need you 10 years from now, 30 years from now, whenever you're ready, you know. And that's going to be really hard right now, I think. But vital. Oh, and don't worry about college. My money job, I work with high schoolers on their college admissions essays. Don't create your teenage years in service of a college application. That is not going to turn you into a cool, creative, interesting, fully fleshed out person. And some of the most interesting people I've ever met ended up not going to college or going to colleges you've never heard of, and then still living full, creative, fascinating lives. So people will tell you stuff that's the most important thing, and it's not.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time. It's awesome to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Matthew. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure.
You know, as I was listening over this conversation with Sarah, I realized that we didn't really go into that more sort of private territory of transness, like the nuts and bolts of being trans in this world. Now, that subject area is extremely important when it comes to understanding the material impacts of current fascist culture war attacks on trans people, the cancellations of care, the barriers in public space, the rage that just bursts out in response to the simplest requests for accommodation. So that's all very important material. And for that sort of examination, I highly recommend any episode of Death Panel where Jules Gill Peterson is a guest or co-host. So I think it's okay that we kept things out of that more granular territory, not just because there are so many great people doing that work, but because one of the things I see happening with trans people and activists is that even when supported by allies, they can wind up doing a lot of hand-holding for people who struggle to understand the very basics. So I've had some friends say that while it's politically helpful, it's worthy and noble as a responsibility, it can also shrink their experience down to gender alone when, as for all of us, gender is only a part of who they are. So I've spoken to friends who will say, I would really love to not be thinking about this as much as I do, but I don't really have a choice at the moment. Now, not having to think much about gender is exactly where most cisgendered people, especially male ones like myself, live our lives. And it's a kind of invisible privilege. And whiteness is the same. So for a white cis man whose success in life is aided by whiteness and cisness, these are things that are largely invisible to me. And that's the self-protective power of the normal. But I have had some revelatory moments. So in the spirit of doing some of this gender reveal labor that trans folks are always getting stuck with when they want to be doing something else, I want to close with my own story about the granular quality of gender in my experience. So I remember about 10 years ago, a colleague of mine posted a call out for a GoFundMe to help pay for gender reassignment treatments. And I remember feeling really weird about it. I didn't know any other trans people personally at the time. And I suppose I hadn't put much thought into that experience of being in the world. And I found that I just couldn't understand it for all of the typical sort of bigoted reasons. But it wasn't just about a lack of understanding. It didn't stop at bafflement. It went farther into a kind of irritation, into why couldn't this person do therapy? Why couldn't they accept reality and just get on with things and not put their friends in this awkward situation of having to support or decline the request? Which in itself, I didn't realize at the time, is a sign of stigmatization and marginalization and othering, because gender care was not seen by myself or by the majority culture as healthcare, because it was considered, and in many places still is, a cosmetic patch for a psychological issue. So of course it wouldn't be covered by insurance or national health. So I remember that this all bothered me, and then it started bothering me that it bothered me. Like, why did I feel so strongly about it? Why did I care? If my friend got the $15,000 they needed for gender care, did somebody lose something? Did somebody get injured? Did anyone die? Was the great communist revolution delayed? No. But sometimes, if you really ask that question about feelings you can't understand, the answer swings around to, well, I'm the problem here. And this is making me feel a whole bunch of things, and that's what I'm responding to, and I should try to figure this out. So I had started that process of investigating why I had feelings at all about this, why I should care. And then I was riding the subway one day, and I had this experience of kind of deja vu-ishness that reminded me of this moment in my teens, which is related. I'll try to tie these things together, but it's the first thing that I connected it to. So I may be 13 years old, and I sit down on this subway car, and like a light switch going off, I experience about 10 minutes of profound alexia. Now, some of you might have heard of agraphia, that's losing the ability to write, but alexia is losing the ability to read, sometimes spontaneously. And as I said, the condition just sort of snapped on like a light bulb. I was looking at all of the advertisements, and I just couldn't for the life of me read any of the titles or copy. There were letters there. They were ostensibly Roman letters, but they might as well have been in Cyrillic or even Klingon, for that matter. And so suddenly I was in a world in which I was mystified as to the meaning of things. It had never happened before, hasn't happened since, but I can say that this instant of acute mystification has never left me. But was it mystification, actually? Or was it me seeing the granular detail of how I was constructing my world unconsciously because suddenly it wasn't working? Okay, so that's when I'm 13. About 10 years ago, I'm 44, and I'm struggling with my colleagues' choices. In fact, I'm having intrusive thoughts about how exactly the treatment would go. What would the surgery be? What would they look like afterwards? Where would the scars be? What would they look like? And feeling conflicted about all of this sort of gross, intrusive stuff, because a big part of me knew it just couldn't be any of my business. And maybe there was enough pressure in that, that it came to a peak, and I had no choice but to resolve it. And so I walk into a subway car, and I look around. And suddenly, everyone I see is somehow different, odd. In the same way the invisible normalcy of written English had vanished all those years ago to reveal mere forms, I was now seeing people without the ubiquitous and unchallenged categories of man and woman laid over them. I had actually stopped doing something I had been taught to do, which is to sort people into a gender binary through an instantaneous, abstract process that let me read and understand the world and let me feel safe within it. And I could see that the process was triggered by ephemera. Cheekbones, hair, heels, a suit and tie, a type of bag. Suddenly, Judith Butler made sense, where she says that gender is not something that one is, it is something one does, a doing rather than a being. Now, I had been enough of a feminist to be aware of the demands of women's clothing, hair and makeup, how much work and concern could go into all of that, how much labor it took up. But I hadn't got to that deeper level where notions of gender itself were being put on by everyone, but with varying degrees of social necessity. I was dressing as and performing maleness without realizing it. And suddenly, the conflict over my colleague evaporated because it was replaced by a new question. Who are you really? And why do you think you are essentially you and not who you have been conditioned to be? What costume are you wearing? And as I came out of that reverie, I realized that over my whole lifetime, I have thought I am clocking biological men and women when really I've been encountering gender. And that the only way of measuring one thing against the other would be to take an interest in people's genitals, to have that be an underlying thought. And how weird is that? And not only weird, but contradictory to the entire experience of attraction and intimacy in my life. Because I've never once been attracted to a person after doing some internal checklist on whether I think they have certain genitals. I have only ever been attracted to what people do, because I can't know who they are until much later. And when I find out, who they are is not about their genitals. So there I was on the subway, just looking at people and the multitude of their expressions. Femme, jock, frat boy, andro, twink, butch, leather daddy. Who were these people underneath and through their performativity? Who was I? Why would I begrudge anyone wanting or needing to change anything about themselves? So yeah, that was pretty much a spiritual experience. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care of each other.